KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
The rise of GLP-1 drugs are a huge factor in Weight Watchers' problems.
Even before obesity drugs came on the scene, Weight Watchers was struggling. Now it's filing for bankruptcy.
For Wednesday, May 7th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. This hour, are India and Pakistan inching closer to war?
Also, we'll ask a man who used to run air traffic control what was behind the communications blackout at Newark Airport and whether it could happen again.
The technology lapse that occurred had occurred before and had been forecasted.
And a new list of the most endangered historic places includes a vacation spot that attracted some of the greatest black musicians of the 20th century.
The Hotel Casablanca in Idlewild, Michigan. Louis Armstrong performed there.
Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. On the first day of the conclave in Vatican City, black smoke poured out of a chimney at the Sistine Chapel. That means the more than 130 cardinals meeting to choose a successor to Pope Francis to lead the 1.4 billion member church did not choose a candidate on the first ballot. NPR's Jason DeRose is in Vatican City and says it's too early to predict how long the process might take.
Most recent conclaves have been fairly short, between 1 and 3 days, so I'd expect something in that vicinity. Starting tomorrow, there'll be 2 morning votes and 2 afternoon votes until someone gets a two-thirds supermajority. The thought is that nobody wants a long conclave because it could signal disunity or internal conflicts, and I am not expecting a reenactment of the 13th century papal election that lasted almost 3 years.
Cardinals will spend the night at Vatican residences where they're being sequestered and returned to the Sistine Chapel tomorrow. Three former Memphis officers have been acquitted in the killing of Tyree Nichols, whose police beating after a 2023 traffic stop was caught on video. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports lawyers for the family call the verdicts a devastating miscarriage and denial of justice.
A jury pulled from Chattanooga found fired Memphis police detectives Tadarius Bean, Demetrius Haley, and Justin Smith not guilty. District Attorney Steve Mulroy was at a loss after the verdict, given the video evidence showing officers repeatedly beating and kicking Nichols and leaving him gasping for his life with no medical attention.
I personally think any fair-minded person who watches the video would come to the conclusion that everybody there had some responsibility for Tyree Nichols' death.
The ex-officer still faced sentencing on federal civil rights convictions. Nichols' family is pursuing a wrongful death lawsuit against the city of Memphis. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
House Republicans are racing to agree on a spending bill, but factions of the party are at odds over whether the legislation needs to include drastic cuts to Medicaid. As NPR's Elena Moore reports, moderates won some concessions last night after meeting with House Speaker Mike Johnson.
This week, Speaker Johnson said that at least one of the previously floated options for cutting Medicaid is now off the table, a move that may complicate Republicans' goal of finding a total of $1.5 trillion in savings. And in a letter to Johnson, many hardline conservatives say that goal was non-negotiable. Georgia Congressman Rich McCormick is one of them. He says the speaker has a hard decision to make.
Now you have 32 members that said, this is our criteria. We're not negotiable on this. You cannot pass the big, beautiful bill without the support of the more conservative fiscal hawks in Congress.
Republicans are still negotiating and hope to resolve this and other major differences in the coming weeks. Elena Moore, NPR News.
Stocks closed higher on Wall Street today. The Dow is up 284 points. This is NPR. With delegations from the U.S. and China set to sit down in Geneva over the weekend, China continues to roll out measures meant to counter the Trump administration's tariffs. The two sides confirming the weekend discussions, though it's not clear how long a deal might take to reach or if one can be reached at all. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent yesterday described the planned conversation as initial talks, perhaps more about de-escalation of the current trade fight with China than reaching a deal. The added costs from the 145% tariffs put in place by the administration are affecting China's export-dependent economy. French President Emmanuel Macron hosted Syria's interim leader Ahmed el-Sharaa in Paris today, a significant step in the evolving diplomatic relations between France and Syria. As Rebecca Rossman reports, the meeting marks el-Sharaa's first visit to Europe since taking power following the fall of Bashar al-Assad in December of 2024.
Macron offered a cautious path forward for Syria, stating that if its new government continued on its current trajectory, he would push for the gradual lifting of European Union sanctions. Macron also emphasized his commitment to encouraging the United States to follow Europe's lead in easing sanctions. He further stressed the importance of protecting all Syrians, regardless of their background, and called for justice for those responsible for sectarian violence. This meeting sparked criticism from the French far right, with party leader Marine Le Pen calling al-Sharaa a, quote, jihadist because of his past ties to a group that was later affiliated with al-Qaeda. Rebecca Rossman, NPR News, Paris.
Oil fell more than a dollar a barrel today to $58.07 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. The Pakistani defense minister has warned that hostilities between his country and India could escalate into a nuclear confrontation. These comments come after India, on Wednesday, hit multiple targets across Pakistan in the most extensive attacks in decades. To help us understand what is happening, we have got NPR's Dia Hadid on the line. She covers both Pakistan and India from her base in Mumbai. Hi, Dia.
Hi, Elsa.
So can you just bring us up to date on what has been happening up until now?
Right. So overnight in South Asia, India struck at a number of places in Pakistan and said it was in response to an attack that happened in April where gunmen killed 26 people. The attack happened in a part of the Himalayan territory of Kashmir that's controlled by India. Other parts of Kashmir are controlled by Pakistan. Now, Pakistan denies it has any connection to the attack and says last night's strikes killed 31 people. And today, the Pakistani Prime Minister's office described the strikes as an act of war and says Pakistan reserves the right to respond. And that leads me to the defense minister. His name is Khwaja Asif.
And he's warning that things could escalate into nuclear war because both countries have nuclear weapons, right?
Right. And just to unpack that a bit, Khwaja Asif spoke to Jio. That's one of Pakistan's biggest news channels. Jio only ran a text version of this interview. And that's where Asif says if India continues to escalate tensions, the conflict could spiral into nuclear confrontation. Now, Jio has not publicly released the tape of the interview, but we have seen and heard it.
I mean, this sounds really serious.
Yeah. And it may well be an alarm bell for the international community to intervene more decisively to resolve these tensions. Mm-hmm. But it's important to say that India is signaling that it doesn't want this to go further. The Indian military itself described these overnight strikes as focused, measured, and non-escalatory in nature. Have a listen to Sushant Singh. He's a lecturer in South Asian studies at Yale University and a former Indian military officer. He says India has made its point.
These are just one-off strikes to demonstrate that some kind of revenge has been taken and Pakistan has been punished in some way.
He says these strikes are meant for a domestic Indian audience.
Okay, wait, but is there a risk that things could escalate more from what you're seeing at this point?
Yeah. Analysts say Pakistan may launch its own military strikes for two reasons. First, because India struck places in Pakistan that it hasn't hit in more than 50 years, not since a war in 1971. And a Pakistani security analyst, Abdullah Khan, tells me the army may need to show deterrence by striking back into India.
Pakistan will have to show its capability and credibility. So we might see some strikes from Pakistani sides happening deep inside India.
Deep inside India. What does he mean there?
Well, he means that Pakistan may have to strike the heart of India, somewhere further than Indian-held Kashmir. But there's another reason, too, why analysts say strikes may happen. That's because India suspended a decades-old water treaty between the two countries after the militant attack in April. And Pakistan says one of the Indian strikes last night targeted part of a hydroelectric dam. Now, India hasn't commented on that, but from the Pakistani point of view, what they're afraid of is India trying to wreak havoc with its water supplies, which it sees as an existential crisis. So Khan, that security analyst, says Pakistan may feel the need to show force now unless the international community steps in.
I think international community can avert it if they convince India to respect this water treaty, because that is considered very serious in Pakistan.
Okay, so we've been talking about Pakistan's side of all this, but what is happening in India? Like, what are officials there saying?
Right. Well, officials tell us that Pakistani shelling into Indian-administered Kashmir have killed 15 people, and they've also damaged a gurdwara, a house of worship for Sikhs. People there are stocking up on fuel in case they have to flee. And there were also drills held across the country to prepare emergency services in case of an escalation. So now we're waiting to see what Pakistan will do.
That is NPR's Dia Hadid. Thank you so much, Dia.
You're welcome.
The Trump administration has a plan to send migrants to Libya as soon as this week. U.S. officials have spent the last few months talking to countries willing to take in people deported from the U.S. NPR's Ximena Bustillo is here in the studio to explain. Hey there.
Hey, Ari.
So what's the latest on this plan to send migrants to Libya?
My colleague Tom Bowman confirmed the administration is planning to use Libya as a destination for migrants removed from the U.S., though he cautions flights haven't taken off yet and plans could change. Earlier this week, Rwanda's foreign minister confirmed it was also in talks with Washington about the same issue. And of course, the U.S. has had similar deals already with Mexico and El Salvador. But now the deportations to Libya would be carried out by the U.S. military. It's not clear, though, how many people or what nationalities would be sent under the deal. Tom Source, who was not authorized to speak publicly, says that it would be less than a planeful. President Trump, however, told reporters he didn't know about the plan.
What concerns have been raised about this?
I'd note Libya's UN-backed government issued a statement today that expressed, quote, a clear rejection of this approach. That's the government that controls Western Libya, while a military strongman controls the East. And all these countries have been floated to take in migrants from in Africa, have notorious human rights records. Libya itself is a popular route for migrants from other parts of Africa who are trying to make it to Europe. Human rights groups condemn how these migrants have been treated in Libya.
You mentioned that the U.S. has made other deals to take in migrants and is trying to make still more. Why is this a focus for the administration?
You know, one of the main goals is to send migrants further away to avoid people crossing back over U.S. borders. That's according to Secretary of State Marco Rubio. But there's also practical considerations. About 1.4 million people in the U.S. have deportation orders, according to the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. But there are many challenges to being able to remove these people and get them back to their home countries. One reason is that their home countries may not agree to accept them back, or they have limits on how many people or flights that they can take. So the Trump administration is aiming to make inroads with others to be, quote, third-party countries that can take in these deportees. These are countries that the people are not originally from, but they're going to go, and these countries are willing to take them after they've been removed out of the U.S. So they're a third destination for these people.
Are we likely to see more legal challenges to this plan to send migrants abroad, as we have with some of Trump's other immigration plans?
Yeah, in fact, we have. Immigration lawyers filed an emergency motion asking a judge in Massachusetts to block removals to Libya or any third country. And they argue their clients, who are Laotian, Vietnamese, and Filipino, could be sent in a matter of hours. The judge in the case already issued an injunction limiting the Homeland Security Department's ability to remove migrants to these third countries. In a ruling late Wednesday, they said the order applies to any flights to Libya, too, and it doesn't matter if those flights come from other agencies, including the Department of Defense.
That is NPR's Ximena Bustillo. Thank you.
Thank you.
This week, Weight Watchers announced that it's filing for bankruptcy. The company has become a household name for countless Americans trying to lose weight. But as NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports, it's been burdened with debt as its customers turn more towards medications instead.
Weight Watchers was started by a housewife struggling with overeating in the 1960s. It gained a worldwide following using a method it developed to track food intake through a point system and encouraging members to attend regular support meetings to stay on track. But in recent years, healthcare stock analyst Carl Thiel with The Motley Fool says Weight Watchers was struggling. Then, new GLP-1 obesity treatments like Wegovy and Zepbound shifted consumers toward medical solutions.
The rise of GLP-1 drugs are a huge factor in Weight Watchers' problems, but it's kind of like the log that broke the camel's back. I mean, it's a big factor, but it is by no means the start of their problems.
Thiel says the company was saddled with debt from a leveraged buyout in the late 1990s. In its bankruptcy filing, the company is seeking to restructure more than $1 billion in debt.
Even the interest cost on this debt was a substantial amount of the money that they were bringing in. They were seeing declining memberships.
Last year, its most prominent spokesperson and stockholder, Oprah Winfrey, left the Weight Watchers board. Then, basically, the competition ate its lunch. Weight Watchers says it plans to continue to operate as normal while it undergoes restructuring in Chapter 11 bankruptcy. It still also offers the in-person support groups it became famous for, but its membership has declined as dieting and lifestyle change overall take a backseat to the new treatments.
The drugs, in a way, are an easy solution, and so people are not as interested in the behavioral part.
But Thiel says Weight Watchers was caught flat-footed as it's tried to push its business into telehealth services, selling those same obesity drugs online. He notes there are numerous other companies like Noom, Row, and Hims & Hers already doing the same.
You know, when you can do it through a simple iPhone app, it might be cheaper and easier and less involved.
Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from your part-time controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Rome, where cardinals are in the process of selecting the next pope. One of the most influential Catholics in the United States right now is a 32-year-old tech entrepreneur named Alex Jones. Jones is CEO and co-founder of the prayer app Hallo, an app that has at times made its way to the very top of Apple's App Store. It's been downloaded more than 20 million times. It's big enough that last year, Hallo had its very own Super Bowl ad starring Mark Wahlberg, who invests in the company.
Join us in prayer this Lent on Hallo. Stay prayed up.
Hallo has also attracted high-profile conservative Americans like Peter Thiel and Vice President J.D. Vance, both of whom invested in the company through their venture firms as well. And at this turning point for the Catholic Church, we wanted to talk to Jones about how he's viewing things. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, we're talking about this modern high-tech prayer app, and I'm here in the setting of Renaissance art and these ancient traditions. I'm curious whether you personally find God in these rituals and traditions of the Vatican and the Catholic Church.
Yeah, certainly. I had fallen away from my faith and came back to it really by discovering a relationship with Jesus and the hope and the love and the peace that comes with that through prayer. It led me to all the kind of the ancient traditions of the church. And, you know, there's a combination of the power of technology and being able to reach out to people in a new and modern way and introduce them to a relationship with Jesus, but also celebrating the beautiful tradition of the church.
For the past week, cardinals have been having all these meetings talking about the big issues facing the church. I'm curious, what is most important to you when it comes to the directions the church could go under whoever's elected next?
Yeah, there was a gospel passage here at one of the recent Sunday masses. And it was this scene where Jesus appears to Peter after his resurrection. He then shortly goes on to ascend into heaven, and Peter goes on to lead the church. And Jesus asks Peter three questions, actually the same question three times. And it's not, you know, what is your stance on whatever issue or what are your perspectives on these things? It's just, do you love me? And I think that for us, especially at Hallo, what we try to focus on, but as a church more broadly, I think what, from my perspective, what we need to focus on is what's changed my own life radically is just having our hearts open to the Lord and having him enter them and change them radically and making sure that we are living our lives on fire with a love for Jesus.
Can you give me specific examples of how you do that outside the prayer space, how you do that day to day in your life, in the real world?
Yeah, I mean, prayer is a really interesting thing. It's very different from just meditating. It has to, and scripture is very clear on this, and anyone who's a prayer leader is very clear on this. If you spend 15 minutes in prayer in the morning, it has to lead to a life of deeper love. And so what does that mean? I mean, for me, I'm the dad of three little kiddos and the husband of my wife. And the question is, how can I love them better? But then it's also loving the poor. It's loving those who are most marginalized. It's helping to trying to spend time in service to those who are in the most difficult places in their life.
We've talked to a lot of people, interviewing people who talk also about the church as a political actor in the real world. You know, what is the stance that the church, the next pope, is going to take on immigration specifically, on things like climate change, other stuff like that? What do you think about the church's role as a political actor, the pope as a global leader? How important is that to you?
Yeah, it's important. But I think often we talk about the church as a political institution, like mm-hmm. we would talk about American politics. And the church's primary role is to start with something higher than politics, which is a relationship with Jesus, and trying to share that relationship, the real love and peace of God, with people, and to reach out to people and introduce them to God's mercy and his love. And then, yes, politics and action and service and love for the poor and everything naturally flows from that. And so the thing that we try to focus on at Hallo, the thing I try to focus on in my life, is certainly not the politics, but is the relationship and the love of God.
And with this next question, just push past the awkwardness of me asking you to give spiritual advice to the next pope. But how would you hope that this next leader of the Catholic Church does that as well, living out that in the big decisions he'll be faced with?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I will be taking the spiritual advice from the pope, not the other way around, and will be glad to do so. But for me, the thing that I think all great leaders of the church have in common. And when you look over the last 2,000 years, it's this all-consuming relationship. It's this all-consuming spirituality. It's this peace that is grounded in prayer and in a relationship with Jesus. And it's taking time. I mean, the Pope has got to be such a demanding job. It's the weight of the world on your shoulders. The Pope's job is to share the authentic love and mercy of Jesus with the world. And that has to come from your own personal life. And so that would be my prayer for the Pope, is that he can spend that time growing deeper in a relationship with Jesus and then share that with the world.
That is Alex Jones, the CEO and co-founder of the prayer app Hallow. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Thanks so much for having me. God bless.
If you've ever driven through Phoenix, you might have come across the Mystery Castle. It kind of looks like a giant sandcastle. The ramshackle roadside attraction was built in the 1930s, and it's been falling apart for decades. But there may yet be hope for this Arizona treasure. Today, it was placed on a list of the most endangered historic places in the United States. NPR's Netta Ulubi has more.
This list from the National Trust for Historic Preservation has come out every year since 1988, says its president, Carol Quillen.
Since its inception, hundreds of places have appeared on this list, and the vast majority of them still exist.
The list's spotlight can help save endangered places like the Mystery Castle, profiled in a cable access show made by the Phoenix City government in 1998.
Very eclectic, his design.
Oh, yeah, really?
That's Mary Lou Gulley. She owned the eclectic building until her death 15 years ago. Her father built the Mystery Castle with no permits, no plan, no formal training in architecture. He just pieced it together from found objects and materials.
Sand, cement, water, goat's milk, and caliche.
Now the Mystery Castle faces demolition. Carol Quillen says another place on the most endangered list this year was a resort built for black vacationers during segregation.
The Hotel Casablanca in Idlewild, Michigan. Louis Armstrong performed there. W.E.B. Du Bois went there on vacation. It was designed by a well-known black architect named Woolsey Coombs, and it served as a place of refuge and joy.
The most endangered list also includes California's Terminal Island in the Port of Los Angeles. Once a vibrant Japanese-American fishing village, its residents were rounded up and sent to internment camps during World War II. Devastation from Hurricane Helene last year put Cedar Key, Florida on the list, as well as the regions around Asheville, North Carolina. But none of the sites on the most endangered list this year included any of the historically important government buildings President Trump had targeted to sell off this spring.
I would say the process started before that.
National Trust for Historic push to turn the Wellington into affordable housing. Netta Ulubi, NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Need help reducing your carbon footprint?
Now people can turn to a decarbonization concierge for a hand getting off fossil fuels.
If the route from here to a fossil-free society runs through a multi-thousand dollar plan for each home, then we are screwed.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. Top U.S. officials will meet this weekend with a Chinese delegation in Switzerland for the first major trade talks between the two countries in months. This after President Trump sparked a trade war with stiff 145% tariffs on Chinese imports. The added costs from those policies are finally beginning to take a toll on Chinese exports and the U.S. ports that handle shipment of those goods. Speaking to reporters this afternoon, President Trump says he has no plans to lower those tariffs on China.
We were losing $1 trillion a year. Now we're not losing anything, you know? That's the way I look at it. We were losing with China on trade $1 trillion a year. More, actually. 1.1. But let's say $1 trillion. You know what we're losing now? Nothing.
Today, the Fed kept its key interest rate unchanged for the third month in a row, saying sustained tariffs could both weaken the U.S. economy and trigger higher inflation. The Walt Disney Company has announced plans to build its first theme park in the Middle East. As NPR's Netta Ulaby tells us, it will be the company's seventh theme park globally and its first since Disney Shanghai opened in 2016.
Disney Abu Dhabi does not yet have an opening date, but it will be on an island in the United Arab Emirates that's become a theme park destination, with ones owned by other U.S. companies such as Warner Brothers and SeaWorld.
Our resort in Abu Dhabi will be the most advanced and interactive destination in our entire portfolio.
That's Disney's Josh D'Amaro, who runs its experiences sector, in a company video. Disney Experiences include its theme parks and cruises, and now account for 60% of the company's profits. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
Well, stocks finished higher after a choppy day of trading on Wall Street. The Dow is up 0.7%. You're listening to NPR News. After days of chaos at Newark Liberty International Airport, the FAA is announcing some changes at one of the nation's busiest hubs. NPR's Jacqueline Diaz has been covering the story.
Newark Airport has been dealing with major flight delays and cancellations. And last week, air traffic controllers briefly lost all communications with a plane. Now, FAA officials are making changes aimed at addressing the problems. So far, the FAA has slowed down arrivals and departures as the airport continues to have a shortage of air traffic controllers. And three new high-bandwidth telecommunications connections are being installed. Agency officials believe that will improve speed and reliability, and old copper telecoms wires will be replaced with fiber optic cables. Jacqueline Diaz, NPR News.
In Memphis, Tennessee, three former police officers were acquitted today on all state charges in the 2023 fatal beating of Tyree Nichols. The 29-year-old told police he was on his way home during a traffic stop that spiraled into violence. Nichols was pulled from his car and pepper sprayed, beaten with batons, and hit with a taser. All five of the Memphis officers involved were convicted last year on federal charges. On Wall Street, stocks finished higher after a choppy day of trading. The tech-heavy NASDAQ added 48 points. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station And from Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/IULab. And from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. This is NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington. There was a chilling moment last week at Newark Airport when air traffic controllers lost all radar and radio communications with planes. The Federal Aviation Administration says the blackout lasted 30 seconds. Some reports suggest it was up to a minute and a half. Somehow there were no collisions, but the long-term problems that led to this crisis have not gone away. David Grizzle was the chief operating officer and head of air traffic control for the FAA during the Obama administration, and he told me the challenges range from overworked and understaffed air traffic controllers to old and outdated technology.
Most of the telecommunication system is the very best technology of the 1980s. And like so much of the equipment that exists in the FAA, it is quite old. It's decades out of date. And when it was replaced, it was also replacing technology that was itself decades out of date. And so that's part of the problem, is that the FAA is in a loop where that it only does big technology projects every 30 or 40 years, which means that when they are actually delivered, they're already out of date.
I'm just trying to imagine using a phone from the 1980s or a car from the 1980s. The gap between that technology and the present day is so wide, it is incredible that thousands of Americans fly every single day, putting their life and safety in the hands of technology that is that old and out of date.
It is, in fact, that old and out of date, Ari.
Well, there's that whole set of technology problems, but then there's also the challenge of personnel. Are there enough trained air traffic controllers to do the job of this size that we have today?
No, Ari, there are not. We are short several thousand controllers. And even at the pace of hiring that we are undertaking right now, we will not be able to keep up with retirements and attritions unless we make further changes both to the hiring process and to the training technology which prepares new hires to become controllers.
Let's talk about how we got to this point, because the current Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy blamed the Biden administration. It's also been pointed out that President Trump cut FAA staff earlier this year. Who do you hold accountable?
Let me say, first of all, that I've been involved in the airline industry for over 40 years, and I have never seen a secretary more intensely engaged in aviation than what Secretary Duffy is. And so I have a lot of optimism based on that. But going back to your question, Ari, this problem is decades in the making. The FAA, the air traffic control system, has been underfunded for decades, and the core underfunding status is exacerbated by these government shutdowns and threatened government shutdowns, which seem to be occurring almost on an annual basis now. And each of those interrupts the program development that had been funded. And so we're not getting our full money's worth, even for what is appropriated, because of all of the interruptions in the funding.
If you had a blank check, would you be able to fix this? Is it just a matter of money?
It is not entirely a matter of money. We also need to change the procurement process, because, Ari, any private sector company does not replace its technology in large bundles every 40 years. It is constantly engaged in a process of iterative and repetitive technology renewal. And that's the way you keep a high-tech business in a state-of-the-art situation. And unfortunately, That type of acquisition program is not supported by the federal procurement system.
I guess the bottom line question is, should Americans feel safe flying right now?
Ari, I would not hesitate to fly anytime, anywhere with my grandchildren. The system is safe. And at the same time, safety is not a line in the sand, which you're either on one side of or the other. Safety is a process. And the system is very safe. And at the same time, the margin of safety is narrower than in what it was 10 years ago.
That's David Grizzle, former COO and head of air traffic control for the Federal Aviation Administration. Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you, Ari.
Health officials in Los Angeles County have declared an outbreak of hepatitis A. The number of cases tripled from 2023 to 2024. And as NPR's Will Stone reports, there are some concerning trends.
Hepatitis A is a viral infection of the liver, often spread through person-to-person contact or contaminated food and water due to poor hygiene and sanitation. People shed the virus in their stool and inadvertently pass it on if they don't wash their hands.
Often seen in travelers, in people who are experiencing homelessness, or people who are substance abusers.
That's Dr. Sharon Bolter at the LA County Department of Public Health. She says altogether there have been 165 cases reported since the start of last year.
When the outbreak started, we were mostly seeing it in people who had those risk factors.
And the infections tended to be geographically concentrated, many of them in downtown LA. But that's changed recently.
We're seeing less of that and more of it in places where we're not entirely sure where people got the virus.
And they're finding it in people with no obvious risk factors. Because it has a long incubation period, Bolter says it can be tricky to track chains of transmission. The symptoms can include fever, tiredness, stomach pain, nausea, vomiting, and jaundice. Dr. Timothy Brewer at UCLA says generally in the U.S., which has good sanitation systems and public water supplies, the chance of catching hepatitis A is low. The CDC estimates there were about 3,300 infections nationwide during 2023.
Most people have self-limited disease, so you can feel pretty miserable for several months, but pretty much everybody gets better.
In rare instances, though, the illness can be fatal, in particular for the elderly, those who are immunocompromised or already have liver disease. And seven people have died during the LA outbreak. While it's not clear what's behind these new cases,
if I had to guess, it's more likely due to a contaminated food source than contaminated surfaces.
Brewer says the good news here is that a vaccine exists.
With about 100% effectiveness, and essentially gives you lifelong immunities.
It didn't become standard of care till about 25 years ago, so many adults have never been vaccinated, which is why LA health officials are recommending people consider getting the shots, especially if they're at high risk. Will Stone, NPR News.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tariffs have been dominating headlines lately. The tax on auto parts earlier this month, the flat 145% customs fee on anything from China. So we wondered, how have people been navigating the ones already in effect and those on the horizon? We asked listeners to share their shopping bills with us, and as NPR's Emily Fang reports, Americans are bearing a lot of the costs.
Sandy Alonso really needed a new wheelchair.
It's 10 years old and, you know, pieces are starting to break and what have you.
Alonso likes a specific model that's light enough for her to load into her car herself. But no one in North America sells the model anymore. It's made in China, so she placed an order in March.
At that time, the China tariff was 20%, which is, you know, certainly workable. Not great, but, you know. So it took a while for them to process the order. And by the time it gets to the border and crosses the border, we have 145% tariffs.
By the time it arrived in Tampa, where she lives, it was too late to send it back. She ended up paying nearly $6,000, $3,500 in tariffs alone.
I'm just sitting here going, wow, I can't believe I've just paid this much for this chair.
NPR asked Americans to share their shopping bills to see how the tariffs were hitting them, and they sent in dozens of receipts. And it wasn't just shoppers. Small businesses also sent in screenshots of their new prices. One Colorado business called Hive Tech Solutions makes cold storage boxes for farmers to keep their harvests fresh. These are large refrigerated containers that start at nearly $18,000 a storage box. That's before tariffs. Now they're more than $30,000 each. Their CEO, Kimberly Drennan, decided to put those numbers on the company website for customers, most of whom are farmers.
They really thought that, oh, China's going to pay this. We were like, no, that's not how tariffs work. It's really a tax on us.
Listing those prices was a choice, and it can't be a political one. The Trump administration criticized Amazon when it was reported that one division at the e-commerce giant was considering listing the cost of tariffs. Amazon has since said it will not list those costs. But Drennan says she wanted to be transparent about her startup's profit margins.
You know, we're a small company that has gotten to where we are by people investing in us, trusting in us.
In fact, protecting small companies is in part why the Trump administration argues tariffs are needed to offset foreign-made goods that are uncompetitively cheap and incentivize manufacturers to set up shop inside the U.S. But some business owners say the constant tariff changes have hurt their profit margins. One of them is Mark Bowker, who runs a comic book company in Ohio.
So my profit went from 30% to 16% in a matter of days.
His Chinese supplier, who helps him make his collector figurines, is eating most of the price of U.S. tariffs. But Bowker himself still is facing 14% higher costs and has chosen to absorb most of that cost. Bowker's looked at U.S. alternatives, but says suppliers cannot relocate that quickly. And like most small businesses, he cannot wait that long. He's already thinking about pre-ordering inventory for Christmas.
It's almost time for us to start ordering for the holiday season. And I have no idea how to do that this year. I don't want to end up paying significantly more. I don't want to have too much product on my shelves.
He says he doesn't even know which of his suppliers might still be in business by the end of the year. Emily Fang, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. A Tennessee jury has acquitted three former Memphis police officers in the beating death of Tyree Nichols, who was a black motorist. The jury found the fire detectives not guilty on a host of state charges, including second-degree murder and aggravated kidnapping. Two additional fired officers had already pleaded guilty to separate federal charges. Katie Reardon with member station WKNO in Memphis has followed this trial and joins us now. Hi, Katie.
Hi, Elsa.
So what was the reaction to the verdict in the courtroom today?
Well, the three men, Tadarius Bean, Demetrius Haley, and Justin Smith, hugged each other and their attorneys after they were found not guilty of all charges, even the less severe ones they faced. Now, Tyree Nichols' mother testified during the trial, but the family didn't speak to reporters afterwards. They did briefly talk with District Attorney Steve Mulroy, who said they were still processing, but were devastated.
I think we can understand why they'd be outraged by this result, given the evidence.
Mulroy said that he respected the verdict from the jury that was brought in from Chattanooga, but he said he struggled to make sense of it.
I personally think any fair-minded person who watches the video would come to the conclusion that everybody there had some responsibility for Tyree Nichols' death. But as I said, the jury took a different view.
He mentioned the video there. That video was made public, of course, and it seems that so much of this case revolved around the videos of this arrest, right? Both from the body cameras and a police security camera. Can you talk about how did that video footage play out in court?
Yeah, the videos were really the core of the prosecution's case. When it was initially released in 2023, there was a large public outcry, and Memphis's police chief condemned the officers' conduct as inhumane. It showed officers restraining, punching, kicking, and striking Nichols with a baton after an initial traffic stop that he ran from. But during the trial, defense attorneys told jurors that Nichols evaded arrest and resisted them. They argued that the officers were just doing their job to handcuff him. On the other hand, the prosecution said the video showed Nichols struggling to survive the officers' aggression and force.
Well, as we mentioned, two other officers have pleaded guilty to federal charges already. Do you think that played a role in the verdict here?
It definitely played a role in the case. Initially, five officers were involved, and they were all fired from the police force. Two of them agreed to also plead guilty in this state case. I should note that three officers who were just acquitted, they were convicted last year in federal court of witness tampering. Now, one of the officers who pleaded guilty, Desmond Mills, testified at both trials. He said he used a baton on Nichols after he lost his composure from pepper spraying himself by accident. In that trial, defense attorneys really leaned into shifting blame for Nichols' death to the other officer who pleaded guilty, Emmett Martin. He repeatedly kicked and punched Nichols in the head. And even though the prosecution conceded that some of the officers inflicted more physical abuse than others, they said that everyone at the scene had a duty to intervene, and they didn't.
And real quick, how have people outside the courthouse been reacting to the verdict so far?
Well, I think it's still playing out, but there have already been statements from local leaders expressing sadness and frustration. And then there's a larger question surrounding what this means for police accountability locally. The Department of Justice released an investigation last year that found practices of unconstitutional policing within the Memphis Police Department. Mm-hmm. And the city's formed a task force to address those concerns, but there's some skepticism about how enforceable any changes may be.
Katie Reardon with member station WKNO. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
More Americans are looking for climate-friendly home appliances. There are even government incentives to help them do so. But navigating which incentives to use can be exhausting. Even finding someone to install that new furnace or water heater can be a nightmare. That's why companies and nonprofit groups have created programs to help. NPR's Jeff Brady has more.
In Whittier, California, Lindsay Williamson just wanted to replace her gas water heater.
Very old, corroded, and was super noisy, like boom, boom, boom.
She'd heard about electric heat pump water heaters. They extract heat from the air to heat water and use less energy. One installer came to her house, but then...
essentially just like ghosted us after. They were like, yeah, we can do it, and we'll send you a quote, and then heard nothing, texted, called, nothing after that.
Then she found a San Francisco startup called Quit Carbon. The company had someone ready to install an efficient water heater within a few weeks, and they helped Williamson get government incentives.
This is the shed to the water heater.
The heat pump water heater was more expensive than a gas version, but Williamson used a spreadsheet and figured she'll save money over the long term with lower utility bills.
And other than that, it looks just like a normal water heater. It's gray and kind of ugly.
Quit Carbon launched 3 years ago after CEO Cooper Marcus says he had to hire an expensive consultant to make his San Francisco Victorian home more climate friendly. Walking around his neighborhood, he had a realization.
Wow, if the route from here to our fossil-free society runs through a multi-thousand-dollar plan, just the plan for each home, then we are screwed.
His company vets contractors first by making sure they won't try and talk a customer out of converting from gas to electric. Then Quit Carbon checks out reviews and references before matching contractors with customers. If the customer chooses that installer, Quit Carbon earns a commission. A few states also offer this kind of help. In Maine, there's the quasi-state agency Efficiency Maine Trust.
We are entirely focused on the consumer experience.
Executive Director Michael Stoddard says the goal is to create a lot of demand for cleaner, more efficient appliances by making them easier to buy.
We're not interested in just doing 10 or 20 of these or 100 or 200. We need to do hundreds of thousands, converting these homes from imported, expensive, dirty fuels to high-efficiency, clean electrical systems.
The agency's website answers basic questions, how an appliance works, what's available, and how much it costs. Stoddard says in some cases, customers don't even have to apply for incentives. Suppliers and stores take care of that.
We've worked out the financial arrangements with them behind the scenes. So you just go to the store, you buy the thing, and instantaneously the price is marked down to reflect that incentive.
Nonprofit groups also have programs to make buying cleaner appliances easier. Ari Matusiak heads Rewiring America. The group has an electrification planner, and it offers electric coaches.
Which are basically volunteers, a lot of retired engineers and people who are just committed. And we've trained 1,100 people around the country over the course of the last year or so.
Matusiak says they help people make climate-friendly appliance decisions that many Americans haven't thought much about before. But as climate scientists warn that action is needed to reduce climate pollution, and with more than 132 million U.S. households, a lot more people will grapple with these decisions in coming years. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from BritBox, committed to shaking up people's watch list with British TV, including new original series like Ludwig, starring Peep Show's David Mitchell, streaming now at BritBox.com/NPR. From Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool, customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. From American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org.